Chapter 8. The Voice of America. Cash had played prisons since 1957, and since 1962 he had wanted to record one of these concerts. He believed that no applause equaled the applause of incarcerated men who had suddenly been treated to some entertainment. The first time I played a prison, I said that this was the only place to record an album live because I've never heard a reaction to the songs like the one that prisoners gave, he said. They weren't ashamed to show their appreciation. Despite his enthusiasm for such a project, Columbia wasn't interested. Cash's opportunity came when Don Law, his producer since 1958, retired and was replaced by 35-year-old Bob Johnston, who had come to Nashville from New York where he had been a staff producer since 1965. 30 years younger than Law, Johnston was on the cutting edge of contemporary music, having produced Simon and Garfunkel's Sounds of Silence and Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme, and Bob Dylan's Highway 61 Revisited, Blonde on Blonde, and John Wesley Harding. All popular albums with the newly radicalized college-aged generation. A no-nonsense Texan with a loud voice who thought that record companies frequently failed their artists because executives played safe in order to keep their jobs. Bob Johnston was an ideal partner for Cash at this point in his life. Johnston felt that the executives at Columbia had neglected Cash's career because they didn't know how to present or promote him. They also considered him well past his peak and therefore not worthy of too much attention. They were producing garbage because nobody had any idea, says Johnston. They thought of him as a bag of bones who crashed into telephone poles and tore up hotel rooms. They couldn't see that all he needed was his music. The second he got his music back, he got off all that stuff. Johnston planned to revive Cash's recording career by first identifying his artistic vision and then enabling him to realize it. If Cash wanted to record in a prison, then he'd make sure that it was the best album that could be produced in a prison. He wouldn't take orders from New York-based accountants and marketing consultants. He'd trust the singer's instinct. I signed on to do what the artist wanted to do because I believe in that, he says. It has always worked for me. They chose Folsom State Prison in Represa, California as the venue. Not only had it been the subject of one of Cash's best-known songs, but he had also played there before at the suggestion of Floyd Gressett, his minister friend from Ventura, who regularly worked with prisoners on the West Coast. Situated 25 miles east of Sacramento, it was California's second oldest prison and had a reputation for housing some of the state's worst offenders. 5 massive cell blocks held over 3,500 inmates. After 2 days of rehearsals in the banquet room of the El Rancho Motel in Sacramento, Cash, the Tennessee Three, Carl Perkins, the Carter family, and the Statler brothers arrived at the prison on the morning of January 13, 1968. The dining hall, a cavernous room with a pitched roof, was thronged with 2,000 men sitting at small white tables. Armed guards patrolled the overhead walkways, and because the men couldn't be left in darkness, rows of neon lights blazed down throughout the show. Because the prisoners rarely had a chance to express themselves as a group, the room overflowed with tension. Those prisoners were all power, says Johnston. There was nothing but power. If he, Cash, had gone in there as a wimp, I don't think it would have worked. We would have had a pretty good album, but I don't think he would have done all those songs, and I don't think he would have done them the same way. That's why I made him say, "Hello, I'm Johnny Cash," as soon as he got on stage. He needed to assert control right from the start. Cash had played enough prisons to know the songs that most touched the hearts of those forced to live there. Almost half of his set was either about prison or crime. Another quarter addressed loneliness, separation, and despair. The difference with the prison audience, and this is obviously what Cash knew would translate well into the album, was that their applause didn't just come at the end of the songs, but whenever a line hit home. These men took his words seriously. They weren't there to appreciate or evaluate, but to respond. Although Johnston knew that the applause would be something special, Folsom State Prison wasn't an ideal setup for live recording. The dining hall's high, pitched roof and thick stone walls were an acoustical nightmare. They had to use 5 separate machines, running simultaneously in a truck parked in the prison yard, just to record the music. When I got back to Nashville, I spent about 3 weeks mixing it. I had to take the echo off. I was bringing it back and forth from these 5 tapes so that the end result was what it was supposed to be. Johnny Cash at Folsom Prison kick-started his first major comeback. The album was as important to him in the 1960s as the single I Walk the Line had been in the 1950s. It sold 6 million copies, reached number 13 in the pop charts, and led to Johnny Cash at San Quentin, which in turn led to his network television series. At the end of 1969, Columbia Records president Clive Davis would announce that Johnny Cash had sold more records in the U.S. that year than the Beatles. The album cemented Cash's image as an outlaw. It didn't matter that he never served real time. What mattered was that he not only looked the part, rugged and weathered, but he identified with a huge audience of hardened criminals in a way that implied he was on their side, not that of the law. Many of the songs, written from the perspective of the imprisoned, addressed the guards with a mocking sneer. In Cocaine Blues, the lines, "Early one morning while making the rounds, I took a shot of cocaine and I shot my woman down," were met by a wave of applause, presumably coming from men who'd either done the same or wished they could. Cash did nothing to quell their enthusiasm. Questioned closely, Cash would attribute his concern for prisoners to a belief that they needed to know that they were not forgotten. They may have earned society's punishment, but they also deserve their dignity, especially if they were ever to be rehabilitated. How could we expect prisoners to emerge more loving and caring citizens if they were deprived of love and care? "The conditions are the reasons for the crimes," says Johnston. "You can't lock people up and treat them like animals and then punish them even more when they act like animals. At Folsom, I stood by the doors as they filed in and I stood there as they filed out, and there wasn't one person who looked me in the eye." Cash was also aware of the biblical edict to care for those in prison. In Matthew 25, Jesus distinguishes between those who are religious in name and those whose faith results in action. He says that the faithful who care for the sick and lonely are indirectly caring for Jesus himself. "For I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. I needed clothes and you clothed me. I was sick and you looked after me. I was in prison and you came to visit me." Matthew 25:35-36. "There's three different kinds of Christian," said Cash. "There's preaching Christians, church-playing Christians, and there's practicing Christians. I'm trying very hard to be a practicing Christian. If you take the words of Jesus literally and apply them to your everyday life, you discover that the greatest fulfillment you'll ever find really does lie in giving. And that's why I do things like prison concerts." 10 days before the Folsom concert, on January 3, 1968, Cash's divorce became final. 2 days before the concert, Vivian married Dick Diston, a Ventura policeman. She met her new husband when Cash did a benefit he had helped organize for the Ventura Boys Club. To remarry as a Catholic, she had needed special dispensation from the ecclesiastical hierarchy or risk excommunication. Diston took special instruction during 1967 and converted to Catholicism by the time of the wedding. There was now no obstacle, and Cash could finally marry June. While performing in London, Ontario on February 22, 1968, he proposed to her on stage.